It's Wednesday, April 27, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The headlines in the nation's newspapers yesterday told the story. It all begins with the announcement made in recent weeks by President Barack Obama that he would instruct his Justice Department, under the leadership of Attorney General Eric Holder, no longer to defend DOMA, that is the Defense of Marriage Act, in federal courts. The Defense of Marriage Act, you'll remember, was passed into law and signed by President Bill Clinton in 1996 after both houses of Congress had overwhelmingly adopted it. The Defense of Marriage Act was pressed upon the national interest by the fact that the state of Hawaii was back then in the mid-1990s contemplating the legalization of same-sex marriage. The Defense of Marriage Act was put into place so that the federal government would stipulate that so far as it is concerned, marriage is the union of a man and a woman. But there was another issue at stake given the Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. DOMA also stipulates that no state can be required to recognize a same-sex marriage performed in any other state. But now DOMA is at the center of the target of those who are trying to normalize and fully legalize not only homosexuality but same-sex marriage. And now, as DOMA has been under sustained attack and lawsuits against it have been passing through various levels of the federal courts, we now have the White House instructing the Justice Department. Remember that the Attorney General is the chief attorney on behalf of the United States of America, not to defend the constitutionality of DOMA in federal court. This is a fairly unprecedented action by the White House, and it demonstrates the fact that President Obama does not want the federal government to be in the position of defining marriage as the union, and only the union, of a man and a woman. But far more is at stake here, and that becomes clear in recent days. The headlines yesterday told of an intimidation that is not only now successful, but is a sign of things to come. The Atlanta law firm of King & Spalding had decided to accept the responsibility on behalf of the House of Representatives to defend DOMA in court. One of its lawyers, Paul Clement, a former Solicitor General of the United States, has the responsibility to be the lead lawyer now on behalf of the U.S. House of Representatives. The House of Representatives is here acting because the White House and the Senate did not. On behalf of the federal government, it has hired its own counsel, in this case, Paul Clement, and in the case of his law firm, King & Spalding. But what happened was that on Monday, King & Spalding announced that it was withdrawing from the case. The very prominent international law firm based in Atlanta, Georgia, said that it was now not only reevaluating its acceptance of the case, but severing all relationships with it. Robert D. Hayes, Jr., the chairman of King & Spalding, issued a statement in which he said, "In reviewing this assignment further, I determined that the process used for vetting this engagement was inadequate. Ultimately, I am responsible for any mistakes that occurred and apologize for the challenges this may have created." End quote. Well, what's really going on here is very clear. Homosexual rights organizations had brought intense pressure against King & Spalding, pressuring them to drop the case, not to defend DOMA in court. And that has become especially clear in recent days with emails that have been leaked from the group known as the Human Rights Campaign. The Weekly Standard, that magazine, obtained copies of the emails and posted them on the website. From the Human Rights Campaign email, you read, for instance, where it reads, "Later that day, we announced the elements of our campaign to show King & Spalding's hypocrisy for taking on the defense of DOMA while touting their gay rights policies, including a 95% score on the Human Rights Campaign's Corporate Equality Index. In the meantime, we also contacted many of the firm's clients, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender student groups at top law schools, and used social media to inform the public about King & Spalding's wrong-headed decision." End quote. Now, the success of the group's efforts to intimidate King & Spalding should serve as a warning of things to come. This is the kind of intimidation that will be used against any organization or institution or law firm or school that takes a controversial case and opposes the agenda of the gay rights movement. Watch and be warned. Paul Clement, who justified his decision to leave King & Spalding and to continue to take on this case on an individual basis with a new law firm, said this. He spoke about the role of attorneys, quote, "defending unpopular clients is what lawyers do." Now just consider this for just a few moments. Mr. Clement, who served as Solicitor General of the United States under former President George W. Bush, here is justifying the fact that he is continuing this legal role by explaining that in this case, the House of Representatives and the vast majority of Americans who pressed for DOMA now represent unpopular clients. who deserve representation even over against public scorn and scrutiny. What we're watching here is a moral revolution of just almost incalculable scale. The issue of homosexuality represents a moral turn in the culture that is, well, to use the word revolutionary, seems to be a significant understatement. We're talking here about an attorney who's doing the noble thing of defending the Defense of Marriage Act in court, who is now on the defensive, explaining that what lawyers do is to defend unpopular clients. Unpopular, in this case, refers to the Defense of Marriage Act, signed into law by President Bill Clinton just a few years ago in 1996, an action undertaken and passed by overwhelming majorities in both houses of the U.S. Congress. What we're talking about here is a lawyer who's going to be representing the U.S. House of Representatives, explaining that defending unpopular clients is just what lawyers do. Now, watch this very carefully. This kind of intimidation in this case was exceedingly successful. Gay rights organizations are championing and crowing about their success in getting King and Spalding to drop this case. This is a sign of things to come. And this is a very concrete warning of the kind of intimidations that are certainly to be repeated in the future. Across America right now, perhaps one of the major concerns of many people, especially in the midsection of the country, is the weather. The tornado season this year has brought an unprecedented number of strong storms. According to the U.S. Weather Service, preliminary estimates are that there have been at least 250 tornadoes so far, not this year, just this month, just in the month of April, and in all likelihood, many more are to come. Greg Carbon, who was the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service, says that more is likely to come even in this month and in May, which in many parts of the country is the wettest month of the year. So far this year, and this was as of Tuesday morning, tornadoes have killed at least 41 people. But over the last several hours, you can add at least 8 to that out of Arkansas. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, that we live in the contemporary moment. We tend to think that what's happening now must be different than what happened in the past because the past recedes into memory. But if you're counting tornadoes this year, it's not a figment of the imagination. Not only are there more tornadoes at this point than in any normal year, but there are more of the particularly dangerous, more forceful tornadoes as well. Howard Bluestein, however, a meteorology professor at the University of Oklahoma who specializes in tornado research, told the New York Times, "It's unusual, but it does happen. This isn't a sign that the world is about to end." Contrast that with a woman, Candace Shaw, a frequent business traveler who arrived at the St. Louis airport to discover all the windows blown out and significant damage. She said, "We've had nothing but tornadoes. I feel like I'm living in the land of Oz." Well, she's not the only one. There are a lot of others who feel like they're living in the same country. And let's remember, there are very real lives out there that are at stake. We need to pray for those grieving families and grieving communities. At the same time, there are things for which we should be thankful. If you saw the pictures of the neighborhoods destroyed there in St. Louis by that massive storm, it seems incredible to contemplate the fact that no one in those massive homes destroyed in all those neighborhoods was killed. And so there's reason for thankfulness, even in the midst of the storm. Speaking of the storm here in Louisville, Kentucky, experts now advise that the Ohio River may crest at approximately 10 feet above flood stage, a 17-year high in a region of the country that is susceptible, of course, to flooding, as the nation's major river systems going all the way from the northeast to traveling down to the Gulf Coast are swelling with waters far beyond their capacity. There are reports of scattered outbreaks of severe flooding in states like Missouri and Illinois. But you need to pray for the entire midsection of the country, especially the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys, where it's not only those great rivers, but also their tributaries, which threaten to flood. And there are few things that are more dangerous and devastating than flood. On the international scene, the big story ought to be Syria. There are now reports coming out of Syria that the Syrian government's crackdown has led to the death of at least 200 persons throughout that beleaguered nation. Now, here's where our moral and critical faculties need to kick in for some very keen thinking. Let's just remember that what's going on across North Africa and throughout the Middle East is an unrest of unprecedented scale in terms of modern times, but it is also a sign to us of the moral complexity of trying to deal with these things. President Obama said that we were going to intervene in Libya for a very short amount of time in order to make a decisive difference on behalf of the beleaguered civilians and refugees and the rebel groups there fighting Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi. Well, it turns out that it now appears that just this military action from the air is not going to be sufficient. We'll be talking about that more in coming days, but that military analysis now seems to be rather widespread, if not a consensus. But one of the moral questions has to come down to this. Why did we intervene in Libya and not elsewhere? If the lives of civilians were the singular criterion, then it looks like Syria is perhaps where we should have put our interest. 200 civilians already killed by the security services there in Syria with the crackdown of a tyrannical dictatorial regime. But if you're concerned about Syria, the complications are just many. David Sanger, reporting for the New York Times, points out that one of the traditional mechanisms by which the United States and other Western nations have exerted their influence is through economic sanctions. But Syria is already under all these economic sanctions to evidently very little effect. Now, there's one data point here that I found absolutely surprising. One administration official from within the Obama administration, speaking on condition of anonymity, expressed the frustration of trying to deal with Syria economically. He said this, quote, "We're talking about a country whose economy is about the size of Pittsburgh's. There are things you can do to amp up the volume of the sanctions, but the financial impact is slim." That's an entire country. Their entire economy is about the size of the United States city of Pittsburgh. And thus, well, the sanctions just don't seem to matter. And what does that tell us? It tells us that if you are indeed Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, you're not so concerned about the money. You're concerned about the power. You're willing to let the money go in order to keep the power. But there's another lesson for us to consider here, and it's something that we might not see were it not for the international press and, quite frankly, for the internet making voices heard that otherwise would never have been heard. Under the notable and quotable column of yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, we can read a Syrian writer, in this case Fareed Ghadri, write about his country on an article he posted on the internet on April the 24th. He said this, "It is unconscionable to think that people are dropping like flies on Syrian streets. The injured are hiding in private homes to avoid capture or cold-blooded murder. The funeral procession are being shot at, with many killed at a time they bereave the dead. The detained are tortured and many die and are buried in mass graves. Yet the international community seems only willing to extend words of comfort. Then comes Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, who thinks Gaza is tragic with its people under siege and tyranny, while Syrians under his buddy Assad enjoy comfort and freedom. Where is your humanitarian flotilla to Syria, Erdogan? Are Gazans better people than Syrians? Is Assad too dear a friend for you to bother? And where are the Hamas Palestinians who seem to forget everyone's tragedy except their own?" End quote. You know, one of the great moral issues of our time is what's going on in the Middle East that is and is not talked about. When you look at the beleaguered Palestinians, we need to remember that the first to abandon them and the first to use them have been other Arabs and other Muslims. And in the case of Syria, the question is, why are all of these leaders speaking out about problems elsewhere but not in Syria? In this case, this Syrian spokesman makes the issue very clear. Why are people silent when it's their friend who is doing the killing? We need to keep all this in mind when we remember just how morally complex these great questions of world affairs really are. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.